The title of the next 3 minutes discussion is integrated circuit devices, or what to use where. Should you wish to follow this in the notes, you'll find it's under chapter 3, which is titled Binary Arithmetic, actually the second part of lecture 3. My colleague Professor Field has introduced the idea of the basic building block of control systems, the gate, NAND gate, NOR gate, inverter, or whatever. The purpose of the next few minutes is to discuss the physical realization of these devices in integrated circuit form. There's a profusion of terms used to define the characteristics of different families. What I hope to do is to, shall I say, clear the mist somewhat, dispel any confusion which may be in your minds as to what the different terms mean and how we can differentiate between different types of digital integrated circuits. The first two terms which you're liable to come across are the terms monolithic and binary. All integrated circuits fall into one or the other class. The terms describe the way in which the integrated circuit is manufactured. Monolithic literally means a single block or a single stone, and it describes a process whereby a single chip of a semiconductor material, generally silicon, is used to form the complete integrated circuit by processes of diffusion, masking, and etching techniques. It's possible to diffuse into the actual crystal of semiconductor material passive and active components to create a particular circuit. We might look upon monolithic as being the true semiconductor IC to distinguish it from the hybrid kind. The hybrid kind is, if you will, a super micro miniature printed circuit board. It consists of a substrate, but not a semiconductor substrate, ceramic or some inert material. And bonded onto the surface of this material are passive components. They're fabricated by more or less conventional discrete component techniques. Interconnection between components is made by fine gold wires using fine welding techniques, and semiconductor devices, diodes, and transistors are fixed physically on this very small substrate. Digital integrated circuits are generally of the monolithic kind, and about 80% of the total number of ICs manufactured and sold are digital in nature. There is another whole class, another whole breed that we shan't be talking about at all today called linear. And these are integrated circuit devices such as operational amplifiers or IF strips, demodulators, and so forth. Linear because the components are acting within the linear region of their characteristics, as distinct from digital, which are either on or off, two-state in nature. So we have these divisions, as it were, of the whole area of integrated circuits. We can divide them functionally into linear types, amplifiers, or digital types. This is what we're talking about today. The most digital types are monolithic in nature. We can further subdivide digital types into the various families of integrated circuits, and just given here in the notes are a sample of the major families available. RTL, resistor transistor logic, where the active components are coupled together through resistive networks, DTL, diode transistor logic, where diode coupling is used, TTL, sometimes called T squared out, where you have direct connection between the transistors on the gates, and a whole relatively new area, MOS devices, manned oxide semiconductors, and in the high speed family, or emitter couple logic. There are three terms used to describe the complexity within a single integrated circuit. We talk about small-scale integration, medium-scale integration, and large-scale integration. Now, small-scale integration consists of things on a single IC chip, such as quad 2-input NOR. Quad 2-input NOR means four 2-input NOR gates on a single chip, or a dual JK flip-flop, which consists of two JK flip-flops on a single chip. JK flip-flops will be talked about by my colleague within the next few minutes. Medium-scale integration, then, concerns an integrated circuit where we have several gates with interconnections between those gates made on the chip itself. Examples might be counters, registers, decoders, decoder drivers, small chip registers. Then we have large-scale integration, and this is an area exploited by MOS technology, where we have a memory system for a computer, 2000-bit memory, for example, or a 512-bit chip register. A fantastic array of different gates, or similar gates, but many of them with many interconnections on a single chip. These are becoming relatively inexpensive nowadays. So we have these three major categories: the small, medium, and large scale integration, MSI, LSI, and I suppose SSI. Well, I can't recall meeting that particular term. Now we have these various families of digital integrated circuits as shown on this slide here. But before we discuss them in any detail, let's talk about the different ways in which we can define the properties and the characteristics of a particular family or a particular gate within a family. The first term one is likely to meet is the fan-in, fan-out terms. And simply put, a gate with a fan-in of four would be one which has four inputs, such as a 4-input gate. Fan-out defines the number of outputs that a particular gate can drive, like it's analogous to the source impedance of a generator. A device with a high fan-out, say a fan-out of 10, presumably could drive 10 inputs. This simple idea of fan-in and fan-out presupposes that within a particular family, the loading presented by a single input is the same for all gates, and in fact this is not true. We find, for example, with Texas TTL, that within that TTL family there are three sub-families, as it were, or subgroups, and even within a single subgroup there are different loadings presented by different gates. So we introduce the term of a unit load. We say a device has a fan-out of, shall say, 20 unit load. And this would mean to say that it could drive 20 input gates if each gate had a unit loading of 1. Or it could drive 10, each of 2 unit loads, or 5, or 4 unit loads, and so forth. So, in a way, fan-out defines the power handling capabilities of the gate. We have special gates with high fan-out, or power gates, or line drivers, sometimes over collector gates as well, which are particularly designed and manufactured to drive a fairly heavy load, such as a length of 80 meter coax or something for a peripheral device, say for a computer which is working remotely from some system. You have to drive the capacitance of that line with some kind of a high power gate. So there are the means then of improving the fan-out of a particular gate is merely to insert a buffer or a line driver at the output to drive the necessary number of gates. Likewise, there are facilities for increasing the fan-in of a gate. If, for example, you have an AND gate with a fan-in of 4 and you just got now a fan-in of 8, then one can use expanders. And I won't go into this in any more detail because it is covered partially in the notes. In any way, in a particular instance, it's best to consult the manufacturer's information as to how this expansion is performed or how you can realize it. Noise margin is a particularly important area in control systems, where you have a very noisy environment, a very hostile environment. Imagine an arc welding shop where you are switching hundreds of amps almost instantaneously, which is going to generate very fast, furious, transient spikes on the line. And this is going to flow right through your power supply and finally wind up on the input to a gate. And if that input spike should exceed a certain threshold level, then that gate will switch when it shouldn't do. And the answer to designing systems for working in these kind of hostile environments are to use possibly high threshold logic, a particular family of integrated circuits which are designed to have a high output voltage swing, for example, approximately 0 volts for logical 0, and something like 12 or 13 for logical 1, so that any noise that is induced on the input to a gate is not sufficient to raise the input through the threshold and cause it to switch. High threshold logic then is one answer. Well-regulated power supplies is another, although it's very difficult to design a power supply which will regulate the speed substantially faster than a microsecond, and these transients can be in the nanosecond region. And of course there are the more conventional grounding and screening answers to these problems. There is an application note from Motorola in your notes which goes into it in fine detail that I can cover here. But noise immunity, then, is another specification by which we can compare the characteristics of different families. Power dissipation is generally quoted, two figures, one for when a gate or a flip-flop is in the on condition, and one for when it's off, or, in some cases, an average power dissipation for when the gate is switching with a 50-50 on-off ratio. Power dissipation is, of course, more important when you have many gates. Look at the power dissipation of a small scale integration SSI chip. It may be of the order of milliwatts, even what's milliwatts, but when you multiply that by 100, it could be a system which is going to demand amps. And so power dissipation is important, and there are families, Motorola milliwatt RTL logic, for example, which are designed to operate with low power. Operating speed is not particularly critical in a control system environment where we have, say, mechanical operations which are fairly slow in comparison with the switching speed of semiconductor devices. In a mini computer, it's much more critical, of course. And typically, in mini computers, you'll find a TTL logic family is the choice on the grounds of speed and expense. The point to make here is that a gate does not switch instantaneously. There is a finite delay between an input logical state change and the output. And this can be of the order of just a few nanoseconds for a fairly high-speed logic family, or as slow as 50 nanoseconds or more. Because in 50 nanoseconds, that's a very short interval of time when you're talking about some mechanical operation. So one can generally neglect it. Well, having briefly covered then those specifications, let's go back to our previous chart of the different families and talk, see how they compare on the basis of these different specifications. Resistor-transistor logic is typically rather slow, amperage figure. These figures here, by the way, must not be taken too literally at all. They're very broad, just to give some kind of a feel for the order of magnitude that we're speaking of, has a fairly slow, moderate cost. Its noise immunity is not particularly good. It can have fairly low power dissipation, which I suppose would be its major claim to fame. It suffers particularly in terms of low fan in and fan out. DTL, or diode transistor logic, is noted for its good noise immunity. High threshold logic is, as it were, a subgroup of DTL. It's reasonably low priced. Its switching speed is moderately good, around 25 nanoseconds. And power dissipation, not so good as RTL, but it does have good fan in and fan out capabilities. TTL is undoubtedly the most popular fandom in terms of quantities. I'm sure it must exceed all the others by a significant margin because it's using so many, many computers. It's got medium quality as far as noise immunity is concerned. Its cost is fairly good, actually, possibly a little bit better than medium. Switching speed is 10 nanoseconds, or thereabouts. Power dissipation is increased. You'll notice, by the way, that there's a general trade-off here between propagation delay or propagation time and power dissipation. The slow-speed devices here have got fairly low power dissipation. As we increase the switching speed of the device, we suffer in terms of extra power dissipation. Until we get to ECL here, emitter couple logic, which is just about the fastest family with 5 nanoseconds or better, but quite a high power dissipation. This is a trade-off. To get back to TTL, moderately good fan in and fan out. ECL is the high speed family, using high speed, very high speed computing, reasonable noise immunity, and good propagation delay, but suffers from fairly high power dissipation, which is moderately quite expensive too. MOS devices are almost a breed in themselves. The previous families, pure transistor devices, are called bipolar to distinguish them from MOSFETs. Historically, MOS has been rather slow in switching speed, but it has had the advantage of being very readily implementing large-scale integration. At this particular moment in time, the present state of the art, MOS, LSI, large-scale integration, is becoming very competitive with TTL. And the various authorities within the industry who are forecasting that it will exceed TTL in terms of popularity. The speed problem is being overcome, so this figure of 50 nanoseconds here should be taken to the pinch of salt probably in the next year or so. Speed will be improved. Well, in fact, right now, the speed's much faster than 50 nanoseconds in MOSFET. And the particular advantage, I say, is that they readily implement LSI, and thus they're finding many applications in digital calculators, where you can get pretty well a whole arithmetic processor of calculating a desktop calculator on a single chip, which is quite a fantastic degree of complexity. And the concept of the computer chip is nowadays becoming physically realized. This is where you have the whole central processor on a single IC chip, large scale integration, MOS devices. I think that just about concludes my presentation. Thank you for your attention. My colleague will now continue with a discussion of two state devices or flip flops.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
You mentioned this unit low. Then you reference fan out. So when you say one of these is stable, fan in 3, fan out 4, is that 3 unit loads, 4 unit loads, approximately?
There's a little bit of confusion here. What we're really doing is talking about a particular family, so we shouldn't be too precise and say figure 3, and that's it, point 1. What we mean when we say TTL, for example, has a fan in of 8, we say that typically a small scale integrated IC TTL family will have approximately 8 inputs. So that you could expect to find, for example, 4 2 input NANDs or 2 4 input NORs or NANDs. So typically in a small scale integrated circuit chip, you'd find about 8 inputs. And that's the basis upon which they're compared.
Well, how much is a unit low? You said you could have, if you switched from 20 of 1 unit low, 10 of 2 unit low, or 5 of 4 unit low, but how much is a unit low?
You mean in terms of microamps, watts, and power? It's quite impossible for me to answer because in a particular line it will vary, and it's really up to the manufacturer. We'll say for this family, so many unit lows is the loading on the input.
But how do I convert that to something else?
In terms of microamps.
Right.
Then you have to read the manufacturer specification in very large detail. And it's a very complex operation.
No, it's not standard, right?
Unfortunately, no.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, I woke up this morning with only half my voice, and I have two sessions to present. So I hope I'll be able to get long enough and things will go well. There's a chance that my voice may taper off rather than improve, so I hope you'll bear with me if I do have some problems. My session, or this session at least, is on digital memory elements, and it's basically what's contained in chapter 4 of the notes. I condensed what's in there a bit so that we can cover it in about 1 hour. So I'll just progress right away with it. Start. The main part of the talk will be on integrated circuit memory elements. However, just so that you will have some feel for where these integrated circuit memory elements fit into the family of memory elements that are available, I mentioned a few other memory elements on this slide. There are two common types, one magnetically based memory elements. And here we have devices such as core memories, where a ferrite core, very small ferrite core, can be used to store a single bit of information. We progress up to rotating type memories, and there are two common types here. One is a magnetic drum with a number of reed heads on the surface of the drum, what you do is magnetize a small portion of the drum, and then you can read that at some later time to detect what has been stored in the drum. A disc works on a similar principle, except here there's normally only one reed head that you must move back and forth across the disc, similar to a common home entertainment record player. And of course, magnetic tape is another form of storage that is often used with digital equipment. The storage capacity of the devices mentioned here normally increases from core memories up to magnetic tape. Core memories on a mini computer, for example, usually start at about 4,000 words, and you may have 10 million words stored on magnetic tape. So the capacity increases as you progress up this list of magnetic storage devices. However, the speed increases as you go up the other way. Core memories are considerably faster than a magnetic tape, where you only have to search the whole tape to find the information that you're actually looking for. Progressing now to electronic, or what we would normally use now would be integrated circuit memory elements. The basic device is the flip-flop, and we'll talk in detail about flip-flops. Each flip-flop is capable of storing one bit of information, and a bit can either be a 0 or a 1. These are the logic variables that Professor Field talked about earlier. If we combine a number of flip-flops, we form what is called a register. A register is just a collection of flip-flops, which is capable of storing a number of bits, which we often call a word or a byte, just a group of bits. So all a register then is a number of flip-flops, which we use to store a number of bits. As we progress up in capacity, we come to things called read-only memories. These normally contain a number of registers which we can access by applying some kind of addressing mechanism to the read-only memory. So a read-only memory is really a large number of registers, and we can address or access each register within the read-only memory. A read-only memory differs from a read-write memory in that you can only read information out of the read-only memory. You put the information in normally when you buy the memory. You specify to the manufacturer that you want the memory to contain a certain bit pattern, and when that memory is delivered, it will contain that bit pattern, and you cannot change it. Read-write memories, on the other hand, are memories consisting of a large number of normal registers in which you can input information into the memory and read it out at some later time. You can then therefore change, as you're using the equipment, what is actually stored in the memory. So you can read from the memory and you can write into the memory. So these basically are the kinds of memories that are normally used with digital equipment and digital computers. We're going to concentrate now mainly on the basic flip-flop, which is an essential part of at least a register and a read-write memory, and some read-only memories also have a semblance of a flip-flop or a number of flip-flops within the read-only memory. Simplest flip-flop can be constructed from a pair of high-gain cross-coupled amplifiers. And here we have a couple of high-gain cross-coupled amplifiers in the form of a couple of transistors with appropriate biasing and load resistors. Note here that if we have a slight positive signal at the input to this transistor, then this transistor will tend to turn on, which means that this voltage will go low. Go low, I mean that voltage will go towards ground. This then will tend to hold this transistor off, so this voltage will stay low because this is low and it's only fed through a resistor. When this is low, this transistor will tend to be turned off. When this transistor is turned off, it's essentially out of the circuit, so that this voltage will increase. It will go positive. You note now that this will reinforce any small voltage that we may have applied here. So that if we apply a small voltage here, after a period of time, depending upon the delay around this loop, this voltage here will approach VCC, which is the supply voltage, and this voltage here will approach ground, which is approximately zero. And that will then be in a steady or a stable state. So one stable state for this circuit is when we have at the output of this transistor about 0 volts and the output of this transistor about the voltage VCC. So that's one stable state. We can get another stable state by assuming that we start off with a small positive signal at this input. This then will lower this voltage here towards ground. This will turn this transistor off, which means that this voltage will go up to VCC. So another stable state is where we have approximately VCC at this particular output and approximately zero at this particular output. So we have, with this simple cross-coupled device, two stable states, known as a bistable circuit. And this now is the basic cross-coupled type circuit that's used for a flip-flop. Here I've assumed that it will reach one of two stable states simply by the noise that is present at the input. We can force one of two stable states by, for example, applying a positive signal through a resistor to that input. If we apply a positive signal here, this transistor will turn on, which means it will go to the stable state with 0 volts here and about VCC here. Similarly, if we were to apply a positive signal here, we could go to the stable state where we had 0 volts here and about VCC here. So we can add inputs to this so that we can switch from one stable state to another. Now when we have integrated circuits available, we don't realize this kind of device with transistors and resistors, but we normally use the common gates that we have introduced earlier in the course. The simplest realization of this bistable device is shown at the top, where we use a couple of NOR gates as the high gain amplifier. So each NOR gate here is an inverting high gain amplifier, which in effect corresponds to the transistors that we demonstrated or showed before. Now, to look at the behavior of this, we can look at what the outputs will be, A and B, for the possible input combinations that we can apply to this circuit. If R is a zero and S is a zero, and here I'm assuming that we're using positive logic, which means the zero here is really a logic zero, but it also corresponds to about 0 volts. And the one here is a logic one, which corresponds to about, in the case of TTL logic, which is what I'll normally think in terms of, about 3.5 or 4 volts. Okay? So remember that this device can be in two stable states when we have no input supplied. So I indicated that by the truth table here, where if we have two zeros, there will be no change in the device, and we'll either have a logic one here and a zero here, or a logic zero here and a logic one here. If we hold R equal to zero and make S a logic one, or put about plus 4 volts at this point, then because we have a zero at this input, because we're using, NOR gates, because we have a one at this input to the NOR gate, we will then have a zero at this output to the NOR gate. If that's a zero, because of the bistable operation of the device, this will then be a one. So when we have a zero and a one input combination, we will have outputs corresponding to A equal to 1 and B equal to 0. If now we remove S, that is take S back to 0, then we will maintain this output combination. There will be no change when we remove the input. So by applying the input, we can establish the state of the bistable device. When we remove that, that state will be maintained. Similarly, if we set R equal to a 1, that means apply a positive voltage here, don't apply any input here, then B will go to the 1 level and A will go to the 0 level. So this input combination will establish this stable state. When we remove this input, this stable state will be maintained. Now the other possible combination of inputs is when we have both R equal to 1 and S equal to 1. So we have a positive voltage here, a positive voltage here. Because we're dealing with NOR gates, we'll then have about 0 volts here, or logic 0 here, about 0 volts here, which once again is a logic 0. So for both inputs applied, we will have a 0 and a 0. Now if we remove these simultaneously, the device must go to one of the two stable states. But if we do this simultaneously, we don't know which of the two stable states it will go to. So if we have this combination here, while these are applied, we'll get two zeros at the output. When we remove these, that is, set them back to zero, both at the same time, then the final state will either be this combination or this combination, because these are the only stable combinations for this bistable circuit. So this particular application, or this particular combination of inputs for a flip-flop, isn't very useful, because when you remove them, you don't know what the final stable steady state is going to be. It will be this or this one, but you don't know which one. So this particular input combination is normally considered to be an illegal combination for the simple cross-couple or RS flip-flop. This now is a very common form and the most important form of storage element. We can realize this with NAND gates as well as with NOR gates. Here I've shown S bar and R bar as the inputs to the NAND gates in the cross-coupled flip-flop arrangement. I put bars here because in order for these inputs to be active or to cause the device to change state. The inputs must be taken to a low voltage level rather than to the high voltage level, as we did in the case of the NAND wheel, in the case of the NOR realization of the circuit. So if we have R equal to 0 and S equal to 0, then that will give rise to an S bar equal to 1 and an R bar equal to 1. So this is the case where we're not really applying any inputs, so we'll have a no change condition, which is the same as what we had for the NOR gate realization. If R is equal to 0, then R bar will be equal to 1. By R bar, I mean R complement. So we're not applying any R or reset input. If S is a 1, then S bar will be a 0. We have a 0 at the input to this NAND gate. Then we will have a 1 at the A output. We have this 1 here. And because we can only realize two stable states with this device, we will then enter the stable state with A equal to a 1 and B equal to a 0. Similarly, if we have this input combination, R is a 1, therefore R bar is a 0, that's the active input. S is a 0, therefore S bar is a 1, that's not active. This will put us in this state. When we remove these inputs, that means set these back to high levels, we will maintain these stable states. And the other combination, which once again is illegal, or it will give rise to an unknown final state when we remove the inputs, corresponds to the case where R is equal to 1, therefore R bar is equal to 0. We have 0 there. That means we essentially ground that input. We have 0 at this input, we essentially ground that. So in this case, we'll have two 1s at the output. When we remove these simultaneously, we'll then go back to either this stable state or this stable state. Okay, so this is the basic cross-coupled RS flip-flop, and here we have realized it using two of the most common gates. Like to show some voltage waveforms now to indicate how a basic cross-coupled RS flip-flop will respond. Here A is the normal output, which will be the output which really defines the state of the flip-flop. So before we apply any signal, that's in this period of time back here, A is a 0. And at this particular time, we apply a set pulse, which means the S input goes from about 0 volts up to about 4 volts if we're dealing with TTL logic. That then will cause the flip-flop to go into the 1 state, and it will stay in the 1 state. At this point in time, we remove the input. You can note it will stay in that 1 stable state until we apply some other input, and in this particular example we apply a reset signal R at this point in time, so that will then flip the flip-flop back to the other stable state, so it will now be such that A is a 0. We then have a set signal which will set the flip-flop, it will put A to the high level. At this point in time, we apply a reset pulse, which resets the flip-flop. Here we apply another reset pulse, but it's already reset, so it'll just stay in the reset state. At this point in time, we apply a set pulse, so we set it. Here we set it again. Finally, we reset it. You note that even though, if we look at this particular point here, even though there is no input supplied at this point in time, the output of the flip-flop, A, is remembering the fact that the last pulse supplied was a set pulse. Okay, so the flip-flop can remember what the last input was, and this is the whole basis of digital memory. Here it's remembering that the the last input was an S pulse. Here, even though there's no pulses applied, the flip-flop is remembering that the last pulse applied was a reset pulse. Okay, so even though the inputs are gone, the flip-flop remembers or stores information about what the last inputs were. And that's the whole basis of digital memory. I'd like now to look at a couple of simple applications of our basic cross-coupled RS flip-flop. And here we're using our cross-coupled flip-flop as a contact bounce eliminator. When we use switches in connection with high-speed digital logic, the logic will respond to any voltage bounces on the switch, and normally we don't want the logic to respond to these very rapid transients that occur on mechanical type switches. So a cross-coupled flip-flop arranged in this manner can eliminate the bounce from a switch. Here we have a double-pole single-throw switch, which we want to use to establish, for example, a 0 or a 1 level, which is clean. That means has no bounce on it at the outputs of the flip-flop. So if we start off with the switch being in the bottom position, then we have a 0 applied to this input because this is grounded. With a 0 here, B will be equal to a 1. That's about 4 volts. And A will be equal to a 0, which is close to 0 voltage or ground. So let's assume that this device has been sitting there for 2 or 3 days in that position, everything's nice and steady. And for some reason we want to switch our switch to perhaps activate some logic or turn the motor on. What we do then is move the switch up from its bottom position. So when we do that, the switch will be in this position here. Nothing will happen here because these NAND gates will only switch when we apply a 0 input to them. So while our switch is in the middle of this region, the outputs will remain perfectly constant. Now, as soon as the switch touches the top contact, then this point will be grounded. So A will go to a 1. And the feedback arrangement here will cause B to go to the 0. But as soon as this switch touches this top contact, the chances are very good that this point here, which I'll call X, which it has been at some positive level because the switch has been down here, as soon as the contact touches, that will drop down. But because of bounce on that switch, this voltage X will go back and forth like this until finally it will settle at the ground level when it's up at this point. So here we have an awful lot of contact bounce at this voltage point. However, the signal A was 0, and it's a perfectly clean transition to 1. We couldn't feed this signal directly into logic because the logic would respond to every little transient on here. For example, if you're trying to count how many times you have changed the status of a switch, the logic would count every one of these little flips, which is normally not what you want. But if you feed it through this kind of circuit, you'll get one clean transition, and the logic will only respond once. So whenever you're interfacing switches or mechanical devices through high-speed logic, this is a very useful circuit. Here's another very simple application. In the top part of the circuit, we have a relay system with some push buttons to either start or stop a motor. We have two push buttons, a stop push button, which is normally closed, and a start push button, which is normally open. So these two are push buttons, and they'll only make a contact or open a contact when they're depressed. And we'd like the circuit to be such that when we push those and take our finger off it, the motor will stay going or will stay stopped. So if the motor is stopped and we want to start it, then since this switch is normally closed and this switch is normally open, we will have no current down through this branch, so everything will be stopped. When we push this start push button, then we have a path for which current can flow. It will flow down through here. It will energize relay number 1, which has contacts CR1. It will also energize relay number 2, which is the relay which can be used to turn the motor on or supply current through this loop. So by pushing the push button, the start push button, we will close this contact. Current can then flow. When we take our finger off the start push button, we still have a current path down through this loop, so the motor will stay going. Now to stop the motor, we simply push the stop push button. This will break the current path. This relay will drop out, so that this will then be open. When we then take our finger off the stop push button, there won't be a path for current to flow because this relay has opened up. Now we can do some of this using the basic cross-coupled flip-flop in the manner we have shown here. Here we have 2 normally open push buttons going into our basic cross-coupled flip-flop, which in turn drives a relay. In actual practice, you may need some kind of a buffer amplifier in here to supply the current needed to activate the coil of the relay. Let's assume that the motor is stopped, which means that we have, if this is just an ordinary amplifier, we'll have 0 volts here, 0 volts here, which means there'll be no current for the relay. So this will be open and the motor will be stopped. If we push the start push button, we will then ground this input to the 0 level here. This will then go to the 1 level. This will then put some voltage at the output of this amplifier, which will activate the relay and turn the motor on. And we only have to push the start push button momentarily, because once we put this in the state, in the 1 state, it will stay in the 1 state until we push the stop push button. So just by momentarily pushing this button, we'll ground this, put it in the other state, and I'll turn the motor on. To stop the motor system, we simply ground this point, which will cause that output to go to 1, this one back to 0, the relay will open up and the motor will stop. So this is another application for a simple, basic cross-coupled RS flip-flop. Okay, now we're getting a little bit fancy, and we're adding some gating to our basic cross-coupled flip-flop. We call this a gated RS flip-flop. This flip-flop will only be able to change states when the clock is a 1. If the clock is a 0, and if you have a 0 level at this input, and because we're dealing with NAND gates, these 2 inputs will be forced to the 1 level, so the flip-flop can't change state. So if we want the flip-flop to change state, we must raise the clock from the 0 level up to the 1 level. When we do that, then we have a 1 level at this input and a 1 level here. So what we have at this point then will simply be S bar and R bar, which are the required inputs to activate our NAND cross-coupled flip-flop. So we can change the state of this device only when the clock is a 1. So if we have a large number of flip-flops that we want to change under the control of a clock in some particular digital system, we would establish all the R and the S levels in the network. And then when we raise the clock, the network would go to the
states which we would like it to go to, depending upon the inputs. So this, by the mechanism of adding a clock, we can cause all the flip-flops within a system to change state at the same time, which is something that you often want to do. We can, however, get into trouble, and this slide indicates some of the trouble that we can get into. Here I've shown two cross-coupled gated RS flip-flops like we just talked about. So these boxes are the same as the gated flip-flops we have here. We have two of these gated RS flip-flops connected in cascade. And let's assume that this flip-flop is in the one state, and this flip-flop is in the zero state, and that we apply an S equal to zero and an R equal to one. Okay, so this means that when we apply the clock to this particular flip-flop, since it has no S input and it has an R input, that flip-flop should reset when the clock comes along. Now this flip-flop gets its inputs from the output of the previous flip-flop. Okay? So we would then expect, since A1 is a 1, as I've shown up here, that we have a set signal. This is a 0, so we have no reset signal. We will then expect A2 to go to a 1 and B2 to go to a 0. Okay, so this is what is indicated in the slide. A1 is a 1.
The question, when you applying a 1 voltage to the reset, wouldn't you expect to get a reset of 0 at A1?
That's down here?
Right. The output,
well, in past time, A1 was a 1. Okay?
Right.
Now we apply inputs, or reset input. So when the clock comes along, there's a delay through the RS flip-flop. So that after the delay of the flip-flop, A1 will go from its 1 level down to its 0 level. So this time here corresponds to the delay in the flip-flop. Okay? This clock to the second flip-flop was applied at the same time as the clock signal to the first flip-flop. Initially, the first flip-flop had an A1 equal to 1 output, so that S was equal to a 1, so A2 will then be set, and we have the same delay through here. Okay? So what we've done then is transferred the inputs at this level of the circuit into this flip-flop. We've transferred what was in this flip-flop to this flip-flop. Okay, so what we've really done here, by applying a short clock pulse, shorter than the delay through the circuit, we have caused information to be shifted from here into here, and information to be shifted from this flip-flop into this flip-flop. And what was initially in here, of course, is lost, it's just shifted out the end. So we have here the basis of a shift register, where if we apply a short clock pulse, we shift information from here into here, from here into here, which is a common thing that you do when you're designing certain forms of digital logic. Now let's look and see what happens when our clock pulse is long compared to the delay through each flip-flop. Here we have the same inputs applied. We The initial state of the two flip-flops are the same. So here, the clock comes along. A1 will go to the state dictated by the inputs applied to it. So A1 will go from a 1 down to a 0. A2 will go from the 0 level, which it was initially in, up to the 1 level, because 1 level inputs were coming from the previous flip-flop. So A2 will go up to this level. Now, however, the clock is still present, and A1 has dropped down to the 0 level, so we therefore have S going to 0 and R equal to 1. So because A1 is changed and the clock is still there, then this second flip-flop will be reset. Now in this case, we had not shifted what was in here to this flip-flop and what was in this flip-flop to this flip-flop. But instead, we had shifted the input right through the two flip-flops. So when we apply a large clock signal to this particular circuit, you don't realize the shifting type operation that we often want. So a gated RS flip-flop critically depends upon the length of the clock pulse. And this normally is an undesirable feature, and there are several techniques around this feature. The most common technique to avoid this problem is the use of what is called master-slave triggering. And I'll briefly describe now a master-slave RS flip-flop. With a master-slave RS flip-flop, the operation of circuits which inputs to certain flip-flops depends upon outputs of other flip-flops does not depend upon the length of the clock signal. This whole circuit forms a master-slave RS flip-flop. You'll note that, in actual fact, there are two flip-flops within the circuit. One is the so-called master flip-flop, and the other is the so-called slave flip-flop, and we have connecting the two some gating circuits. What we want to do is transfer what is at the inputs to the outputs of the flip-flop by the application of the clock signal. And what happens here is we expand our clock signal. At this point in time, when the clock signal just starts to go high, this will go high, this will go low, so that this gate then will go to the two ones applied at the input to this final slave flip-flop. With two ones applied here, this flip-flop cannot change. So at this point in time, we have locked out this flip-flop from any activity back here at the inputs. Now at time two, the clock has now reached its high level. So therefore, the S inputs and the S input and the R input can be effective in establishing a new state for the master flip-flop. Okay, so all during this time here when the clock is high, the master flip-flop can respond to the R and the S inputs. When the clock starts to go low, this gate will no longer allow the R and the S inputs to affect the master flip-flop. So we then have decoupled the master flip-flop from the S and the R inputs. And at this final point in time, the clock has gone low, so this signal has gone high, and therefore this gate will allow the signals at the output of the master flip-flop to be applied to the input of the slave flip-flop, so that at this point in time, the contents of the master flip-flop are transferred to the slave flip-flop. Okay, so it's kind of a two-stage operation. First of all, you load the master. You can do that all during the high state of the clock. And then, when the clock finally goes to its low state, you transfer what's in the master to the slave. So really, you have two flip-flops in one. And by this means, you can eliminate the problems that you get into when you apply different length clock signals to transfer information from one flip-flop into another flip-flop.
Question?
Yeah?
You've illustrated the slave flip-flop being isolated by having it triggered at a lower threshold level, namely 0.1. Is this actually the way the device works? You get delay by having various thresholds, or you get delay by having additional delay devices inside which are not shown?
No, you do have a different threshold. The normal way you do that, you can do that in a couple of ways. One is you can operate this particular gate closer to its threshold by putting a resistor in there. Or the other way to do it, and this is not the most common way, is to make this particular path shorter than the other path so that this gate will respond faster than the gate at this particular point.
So as far as you know, then, it's actually a threshold differentiation.
That's right. It's normally a threshold differentiation. If you want to build this up, if you just build this up with the gates I've shown here, it probably won't work. But if you add a resistor to this point in the circuit, that will tend to speed up this gate or cause it to operate closer to its threshold, and then it'll work. I'd like to look briefly now at a timing diagram for a master-slave RS flip-flop. Here we have our output A, which is the output of the slave flip-flop. It's a high. At this point in time, we establish a reset signal. Note that nothing happens when the reset signal is applied. At this point in time, we apply our clock signal. On the leading edge of that clock signal, nothing happens to the output of the slave flip-flop. However, the master will be responding while this is high. So during this point in time, this time interval, the master will be reset by the reset signal. And on the falling edge of the clock, contents of the master will be transferred to the slave, so the output will go down. Okay, so the master-slave flip-flop responds on the trailing edge of the clock pulse. A little later on in time, we apply a set signal, and then we apply our clock to cause the action to take place. Nothing happens on the leading edge of the clock, but on the trailing edge of the clock, our flip-flop will again be set. Here we have a clock signal applied. While the clock is high, we apply our reset signal. So inside this interval here, the master will get reset. Here the reset signal is taken away. And when the clock finally goes low, the contents of the master will be transferred to the slave. So here we are resetting. And we carry on in this way to illustrate the action of a master-slave flip-flop. The critical thing is that it's responding on the trailing edge of the clock. Now, in addition to a master-slave technique for triggering flip-flops, there are edge-triggering methods, which also trigger on thresholds, and there are two types of edge-triggering or edge-triggered flip-flops. One is positive edge triggering flip-flops, which trigger a change state on the positive edge of the clock. And the other type of edge triggering flip-flop is a negative edge triggering flip-flop. I think there's something in the notes, but I won't have time to go into this other form of triggering, which is fairly common, but perhaps not as common as the master-slave triggering, which we've covered in a little more detail. So far, then, we've only talked about the basic RS flip-flop. We started off with a simple cross-coupled flip-flop, we then gated it, and finally we added the master-slave feature so that we could cascade or connect flip-flops together. I'll briefly look at a couple of other types of flip-flops. One is a D-type or data flip-flop, which is a flip-flop which is commonly used to lock onto or store the status of data, which could be the output of a switch, into a storage element or flip-flop when the clock signal is applied. There's only one active input, which is the data input, and then there's the clock input to cause the transition or change to take place. I'll talk about these asynchronous inputs in a minute, but these aren't normally as important. So here, the D input is zero. That means we're applying zero data to the flip-flop. Here we have applied one data to the flip-flop. The input is taken to the one level. Our clock signal comes along, and the status of the D input is transferred into the flip-flop, so that Q, which is the output of the flip-flop, then will take the level depending upon what D is. So this could be viewed as a positive edge-triggered flip-flop, where on the positive edge, the state of D is transferred to the output of the flip-flop. Here we apply another clock signal. Our data now is zero. So on this positive edge of the clock, we will transfer zero into the flip-flop. Okay, so whenever we apply the clock signal, we transfer what's present at the D input into the storage component of the flip-flop, which is reflected in the output Q. This is shown by a simple transition table, where D is the input that's applied, and Q is the present state. So if D input is zero, and the present state is zero, that means we're storing a zero in the flip-flop, and the clock signal comes along, then Q prime, which is the new state, will remain at zero. It remains at zero because D was a zero. If the present state Q is a one, and the D input is a zero, and the clock signal comes along, then the new state will be the same as what D was. So in this case, we'll go from a Q of one to a new state, a new Q of zero. Similarly, if the output was zero, and D was a one, and a clock pulse is a five, the new state will go to one level. If D is a one, the old state is a one, and a clock is a five, we'll stay a one. So here the new state is simply the same as whatever the input is applied. And the change only takes place when the clock is applied. So here the new state depends only on the inputs. It does not depend upon the parent state that's stored in the flip-flop. Now let me go back and introduce. Quite often flip-flops are applied or supplied when you buy an integrated circuit form is some overriding or asynchronous inputs. This particular one is shown with a clear input and a preset input. The circles here indicate that we're complementing, which means that this flip-flop will clear or go to the zero output whenever we apply a zero clear signal. So if we ground this input, and we're using TTL logic, it will force this output to a zero. And these, well, similarly, with a preset input, if we ground this, it will force this output to a one. And these two inputs normally override whatever we do at these inputs. So this is just another way then of transferring information into the flip-flop when we don't have, for example, inputs present on the flip-flop. Here is a T-type or trigger flip-flop. With this flip-flop, every time the clock signal is applied, and T is a 1, the flip-flop will change state, okay? So that condition is indicated by the bottom two lines. Here the old state was a 0, T was a 1, we applied a clock signal, So the flip-flop changes state or complements itself, so the new state will be a 1. We've gone from a 0 to a 1. For this particular input combination, the old state was a 1, there was a T input, so the flip-flop complemented itself again, or went from the 1 state to the 0 state. If we apply a clock signal, and the T signal is 0, then no change will take place. That is, the new state, Q prime, will be the same as the old state. Because that's just a simple T-type flip-flop, which changes state every time we apply a clock signal. And this kind of a circuit, as we'll see in one of the subsequent lectures, is very useful for building counters. If T is a 0 and we apply a clock pulse, no change will take place in the device. So no change means that the new state, which is Q prime, will be the same as the old state, which is Q. Okay? It'll just stay the same. If your old state was a 0, and you didn't have any T signal, and you applied a clock pulse, then your new state would also be a 0. You wouldn't have any change. Okay? Okay, this is perhaps the most useful and flexible flip-flop that is used. It's called a J&K flip-flop, and I don't have a clue what J&K stand for. So, don't ask me. It's quite similar to the RS flip-flop. And if we associate J with the S signal, or the set signal of an RS flip-flop, and K with the R signal of an RS flip-flop, the reset signal, then we can understand most of the operation of a JK flip-flop. The operation is described in detail by this state transition table. Here we've listed all possible combinations of the J and the K inputs and the Q output, which defines the state of the flip-flop. So one particular combination is the case where we have J equal to 0, K equal to 0, and the present state is equal to 0. If we have that combination, and we apply a clock signal, then there will be no change in the state of the flip-flop. So for this input combination and state, the new state will also be a 0. Here we have both the inputs a 0, the present state is a 1, a clock is applied. Because there's no inputs applied, the new state will be the same as the old state. Here we have a present state of 0, we have a K input, which we roughly associate with R, a reset signal. We have no set signal, that is J is a 0. We apply a clock pulse. Since we are already reset, we will simply reinforce the fact that the flip-flop is reset in a 0 state. Here, if the present state is a 1, we apply a K signal, or a reset signal, and J is a 0, corresponding roughly to S being 0, this will cause the flip-flop to be reset, so the new state will be a 0. Here we have a no K signal, we have a J signal which corresponds to an S, so in this case we'll set the flip-flop. Here again we'll tend to set it, but it's already set, so it'll stay set. Now here we have both J and K inputs being applied, and this is where the JK flip-flop differs from the RS flip-flop. For the RS flip-flop, what happened to it when we had both R and S applied was not really defined. For the JK flip-flop, the final state, when you have J and K both applied and you apply a clock pulse, is in fact defined. Okay? So, and what does happen is the flip-flop will complement itself. So here, the present state is a zero, we have both J and K applied, the clock is now applied, so the flip-flop will complement itself to go to the opposite state. Here J and K are both applied, we apply a clock pulse, it will once again complement itself and go from the one state to the zero state. So when you have both J and K equal to one, the JK flip-flop really behaves in the same manner as the T-type or trigger flip-flop. It just changes its state. Just to illustrate the flexibility of the JK flip-flop, I've shown here how you can connect the input so that the JK flip-flop can either be a D-type or data flip-flop or a T-type or a trigger flip-flop. To form a D-type flip-flop, you simply make J the complement. Make K the complement of the J signal. And whenever you apply a clock pulse here, what is present at D will be transferred to the flip-flop. Similarly with this arrangement, by applying J and K equal to T, whenever T is a 1, then J and K will be a 1, and the flip-flop will complement when the clock is applied. Whenever T is a 0, these two inputs will be 0. When the clock is applied, there will be no change. So this then operates in exactly the same way as the T-type flip-flop we talked about before. I think I should probably quit and we can enjoy so much. If there's any questions, I'll be happy to try and answer them later on here. Yes?
Thanks, Steve.